It's Friday, July 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hi, glad to have you with us. Coming up, talks continue about Iran's nuclear program. The fight against terrorism takes many forms, including cyberspace.
The history has just been a pick-and-choose history by the flag's defenders instead of recognizing the flag and the war for what it really meant.
Controversy at the top of the flagpole for a symbol from the U.S. Civil War. Also ahead, a dispute between two singer-songwriters. Imagine that. We hear the discord between the musical chords. It's all on today's International Edition. After two self-imposed deadlines have passed with a nuclear deal and talks with Iran, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Thursday in Vienna, if difficult decisions are not made, negotiators are ready to end the process. But it seems that the discussions are continuing. We turn to VOA's Heather Murdoch, who also remains in the Austrian capital, to find out the latest. Heather, what's being said, at least in public at the moment?
Well, Secretary Kerry came out and said that they wouldn't still be negotiating if progress wasn't being made. He emphasized that any deal would have to stand the test of time. On how long they're going to continue negotiating, he was a bit vague. He said they won't rush, but they also won't go on forever, and decisions need to be made soon. He also said that the U.S. is still absolutely prepared to call an end to this process, and that's a quote. Shortly after he left, the Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, came out into the balcony of the hotel, which is a bit far away, but we could just barely hear him. And the journalists were shouting, how long are we going to stay? And Zarif said that the Iranians were prepared to stay as long as necessary.
Well, I don't think Mr. Kerry is ready to buy a place in Vienna yet, but they have gone through two deadlines now, and presumably by time anything gets to the U.S. Congress, they're going to be in recess. So this is going to take some time, and I guess they have decided to dig in for a while.
That's what it seems like. A lot of people, including myself and my colleagues, have already extended their hotel reservations and planning to stay. I'm not sure how long. I mean, there was a lot of speculation when this process began here in Vienna this time around, that if they didn't get it in by, say, the 9th of July, that it would possibly get crushed in Congress. But they wouldn't be still negotiating a deal, I think, that doesn't have a chance of surviving in the U.S.
The devil is, of course, in the details. Mm-hmm. The negotiators do not want Iran to have the capability of developing a nuclear weapon even decades down the road. So what are the sticking points at this particular juncture?
One of the main sticking points has always been how much access the IAEA would have to Iran's military sites. I mean, on one hand, they need access to figure out if Iran was, in fact, ever trying to build a bomb and keep tabs on if it would in the future. On the other hand, for a sovereign nation that is not occupied by another country to allow unfettered access to its military sites would not be realistic either. So that's where they're trying to work it out. And as I understand it, just very methodically and bit by bit, because these two ideas just oppose each other altogether. Another thing that's recently come up is the arms embargo, where they've asked for an end to the arms embargo, and that's a sticking point. But I think the sanctions relief in general is also a major sticking point, because Iranians want sanctions relief immediately, and a lot of people in the West want to make sure that the nuclear weapons are not being built and cannot be built before the relief.
Some of the participating negotiators have left town. Have you heard if they're coming back?
Well, the French foreign minister came out today. He's returned. I think most of them have returned. They've been seen today. The French foreign minister came out and said very quickly that they were staying and they would be continuing to negotiate. The French foreign minister has been one of the more staunch opponents, I guess, if you could say there are opponents here. They're not really, but one of the ministers that have been strongest, saying we will not make this deal if it's not strong enough for us.
Well, I hear Vienna is very nice this time of year. It's nice any time of year to speak with you. Heather Murdoch with us from Vienna. Thank you.
Thank you.
We check now on what's trending on the wonderful World Wide Web. G. Abby Lee of our International Edition team joins me now in Studio 22 to bring us more on the Iran nuclear talks. Hi, G. What's new on the social media scene?
Hello, Jim. Just a few hours ago, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif tweeted from the talks venue. He wrote, "We are working hard, but not rushed, to get the job done. Mark my words, you can't change horses in the middle of a stream. He's at Jay Zarif on Twitter.
Always an interesting idiom. What does that mean to our listeners?
It means you can't back down in the middle of something. And the latest deadline for nuclear negotiations between Iran and the six world powers is set for Friday. His tweet can be seen as a response to U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's comment that if decisions are not made, negotiators are ready to end this process.
I see. Has he also been tweeting?
Yes, he has. He has one original tweet today. He wrote, "Continuing to discuss difficult issues this a.m., working diligently to see if agreement is possible." He's on Twitter at John Kerry. He also retweeted a two-minute clip from the U.S. State Department Twitter account at StateDEPT. He said in the clip, given that the work there is incredibly technical and that the stakes are very, very high, we will not rush and will not be rushed. Both of these politicians used hashtag Iran Talks Vienna at the end of their tweets. The social media analytics website Topsy shows that hashtag has been used more than 11,000 times. And surprisingly, hashtag Iran Talks was used more often, with 12,000 tweets using that hashtag.
Some pretty big numbers. What kind of influence do these ministers have on social media?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Jim, because at first glance, it appears Kerry has more clout because he has 551,000 followers on Twitter. That's almost double the number of followers Zarif has. But if you look at their latest tweets regarding the nuclear talks, Zarif's tweet has been retweeted more than 1,000 times and marked as a favorite nearly 2,000 times. Kerry's, which was actually tweeted even earlier, was retweeted and marked as a favorite around 400 times.
Wow. Well, it's pretty true that more people does not always equal more retweets.
Absolutely.
Thank you for bringing us that update. Our favorite number is 1. G. Abby Lee is the one that we turn to for social media. Follow her on Twitter by that very same name, at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
You're listening to International Edition. The United States has been at the forefront in the battle against terrorism, especially following the attacks in New York and Washington on September 11th, 2001. Our colleagues at Al Hurra Television spoke with Richard Stengel. He's the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. In excerpts from that conversation, he described some of the ways the United States is addressing the threat.
In its strange, perverse way almost, terrorism tends to unite people. And I think what happened on 9/11 was something that united people in the world against terrorism, made them realize the United States is also a victim of terrorism. And I would say that our alliances and friendships with people in the Arab world have only grown since then.
The rise of ISIS, how can this problem be dealt with?
Well, we're dealing with it in all kinds of ways. There is the military battlefield, where we have rolled back a lot of their advances and where the bombing raids are effective and they represent a cohesion among the partners and the Arab partners. And then there's also the information battlefield, which is the battlefield that I operate on. And I think since the rise of ISIS or ISIL or Daesh a year ago, there have been a lot more actors that have come into the fray. Arab countries now have mobilized their own social media, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia. As you know, we launched the Sawab Center with the Emiratis, and that is a big new endeavor, which I think will inspire other people in other countries to create similar centers.
We were talking about Sawab Center. What is the goal of launching this Sawab Center?
It's a joint Emirati-American project that will then help coordinate among the coalition partners to create content messages that counter Daesh's social media strength and sophistication, that also present a positive alternative to that negative vision that they are presenting, and also will coordinate the messaging and content from among the coalition partners that are united against Daesh.
After the attack of Paris and Kuwait, some made it clear that U.S. could be a terrorist target. What do you think?
You know, we're all potential targets. Nobody is immune. And we saw that situation in Texas where there was a kind of lone wolf actor. And certainly people in America are concerned that America itself could be a target. But I don't think it's quite an existential issue for America the way it is for countries in the region where it's on your border and they are advancing and they are trying to create a state. So I think the problem is more acute here, but everybody has the problem as well. There are foreign fighters that come from the U.S. too. So it's something that everybody needs to be concerned with.
Some NGOs stress that the fight against terrorism should not be at the expense of human rights and international law. Are you agree? What do you think?
In a democracy, there's a continuum that always exists between human rights and individual rights and privacy and security. And that balance always ebbs and flows. And I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think you can preserve human rights, you can preserve communication, you can preserve free speech, and have stability and strength at the same time. But it's always a very delicate line.
Richard Stengel, Under Secretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, speaking with Al Hurra. This is VOA's International Edition. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley just a short time ago signed into law a measure to remove the Confederate battle flag from the state capitol building. Her act culminated a years-long movement that was reignited last month by the murders of nine members of a historically black Charleston church. VOA's Jeffrey Young asked Jonathan Blanks of the Cato Institute why the Confederate flag remains such an emotional symbol, especially in the southeastern United States.
Why are people still waving a flag from a war that was lost 150 years ago?
I think it goes back to the fact that a lot of people in this country don't want to admit what the Civil War was over. Shortly after the war ended, there started this sort of revisionist history of what the war was about, that it was about states' rights or tariffs or honor. And the South, being humiliated in the war and defeated, wanted something to hold on to. And so years later, when the Civil Rights Movement happened, they brought the flag back. And they're like, this is what we're about. You're not going to take us down again. And they've just latched on to it. Unfortunately, the war was about slavery, and the rest of the country still views it very much that way.
So what we have here is, on the surface, a presentation of this is our heritage. But what I get is a subcontext where this means something else entirely. Why don't you explain that?
After the war ended, the federal government put in Reconstruction in the South. That meant the federal government basically took control of the governments there and protected the rights of the freed blacks there. After that ended, the white majorities reinstituted their old laws, not in slavery per se, but stripped the right to vote, stripped the rights of black citizens. And that's when you saw the reinstitution of the Confederate battle flag in the state flag of Mississippi, for example. And then years later, when the Civil Rights Movement came up, that's when you started to see them again in protests against integration, desegregation, and the like.
We have a situation now in the United States where it is very clear that this flag is no longer acceptable to a large number of Americans. And yet there are people that are still clinging to it and saying, well, my great-great-great-granddaddy fought in the Civil War, and this is the flag he fought under, et cetera. But at this point, isn't it really about other things? Aren't there larger socio issues involved here?
Yes, because every time that the flag has come up, that it's been used, it has been to assert this sort of racial superiority of whites against blacks to end their civil rights. But what was really interesting to me is in South Carolina, a descendant of Jefferson Davis actually called for the flag to come down from their capital, which is, I think, great. But the history has just been a pick-and-choose history by the flag's defenders instead of recognizing the flag and the war for what it really meant.
Do you think it's possible that this thing can finally be put to rest and that people can let go? Or do you think, just from what you know and from what you see, that this controversy is going to continue to drag on?
I think it will drag on in, you know, pockets here and there. People are going to stick to it because there's not going to be any law saying that the flag is illegal. The First Amendment protects the right to fly it. It's just a question of whether or not it's going to be on government property. I think there's still going to be pockets here and there, and there's going to be fights over that. But generally speaking, it looks like, particularly in South Carolina, this is coming down. Mississippi will be a new fight, and there will still be fights on whether or not federal lands, that, like cemeteries and such, that have Confederate soldiers buried there, whether or not they'll still be selling Confederate merchandise and whatnot.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Well, in the minds of many, there's a big question brewing. Is there a feud brewing between R&B stars Frank Ocean and Miguel? International Edition's David Byrd talked with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about it.
There's an old proverb that says that as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. But when it's the music business and you say, hey, I make better music than you do, that's not exactly the same thing. But that's what's going on with Miguel and Frank Ocean. Shauna Renee joins us in the studio to talk about these two young men. First of all, let's give a little background here. This all kind of started when Frank Ocean won the Grammy and Miguel and Chris Brown didn't.
Right. This happened back in 2013. They were all up for the Best Urban Contemporary Album category. And Frank Ocean kind of came out of nowhere. At the time, Miguel was very popular. Of course, Chris Brown was hugely popular. So to have Frank Ocean win this award was very shocking, surprising, and obviously a bit upsetting for Miguel. Now, Frank Ocean got a standing ovation. Miguel would not stand. And that sort of began this rumor. It was the start of the rumor that perhaps there was something personal going on between these two men.
And then Miguel gave an interview in which he said, you know, frankly, I make better music than you do.
He did. He gave an interview with the Sunday Times recently, and he, you know, he said, he was asked, he said, we're not friends. And to be completely honest, and I'm quoting now, and no disrespect to anyone, I genuinely believe that I make better music all the way around. We talk street art, sarcasm, crass humor in high fashion. Peach color moon glisses, the plot thickens as we laugh off of shotguns and tongue kisses. Bubble bath. And so this quote kind of took off and Twitter exploded. And it was like, oh, are these fighting words? Really? Are we now having beef and rivalries in R&B? Because this is something that traditionally is reserved for hip-hop music.
Right.
We never see it in R&B, and you especially don't see it in more contemporary R&B because it's just a different brand, a different feel. So everyone was a little concerned and confused, but then also excited about the fact that finally something's happening in this genre that is of interest. And Frank Ocean is working on a new project. Miguel has a new album out now, so it has piqued the interest of folks who may not have otherwise thought to check out either of these gentlemen.
And he was asked, Miguel was asked, if he had the chance to do it again, would you go back and give Frank Ocean the standing ovation? And he said no.
He said no. No, he said no.
Now, this is a little bit of talking smack. I mean, you know, this is okay if you're, you know, LeBron James or if you're in the NFL or, like, if you're in hip-hop.
Yeah.
You know, but most of the time when you're talking about guys that make this kind of music, it's all more kind of laid back and everybody's a little bit, you know, more relaxed, but apparently not. Apparently, there's a little bit of tension going on here.
Well, and hopefully it'll be good for both of them, because in hip hop, that's what the battles were about. The beef was about making sure that both artists stayed on top of their game, encouraging them to be better, to push boundaries. And both Miguel and Frank Ocean have already done that. So if they can use this to continue to expand the genre and their own careers, I think we'll all come out winners for it.
All right. So what do you think about this? You can let Shauna know by sending her a tweet at VOA Lady DJ on Twitter. She's also at VOA underscore music if you want to just reach everybody in the music department. You can also listen for Shauna in the Soul Lounge by logging on to our website, www.voanews.com.
Well, not much controversy between our Facebook page and our Twitter account. You can visit both of them. We're at VOA Asia on Facebook, and you can log on to Twitter and follow us, VOA underscore IE. You've been listening to International Edition, and of course, you can find our program at voanews.com. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zineb Abdel-Rahman, and we thank you for joining us. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Enjoy the day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
2014 saw no significant improvements in North Korea's deplorable human rights situation. According to the latest State Department Human Rights Report, which was just released, North Korea continues to deny its people basic freedoms, such as the freedoms of speech, press, assembly, association, religion, movement, and workers' rights. Furthermore, reports continued of a vast network of political prison camps in which conditions were often harsh and life-threatening, and prisoners were subjected to forced labor, starvation, torture, rape, and forced abortions. Defectors continued to report extrajudicial killings, disappearances, arbitrary detention, arrests of political prisoners, and torture. The judiciary was not independent and did not provide fair trials. Reports continued of severe punishment of some repatriated refugees and their family members. There were also reports of female victims of trafficking among refugees and workers crossing the border into China. The people of North Korea, said U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Tom Malinowski, should enjoy the same rights and freedoms as the people of South Korea and the people of every country in the world who are able to speak their minds and elect their leaders and to travel where they want, and not to be placed in labor camps because of something they've said or thought or because of who their relatives are. In recent years inside North Korea, there has been far greater awareness among the population of what their rights are and of how people outside of North Korea live. What has sustained this regime over many years, said Assistant Secretary Malinowski, has been its ability to deny people that knowledge. And its ability to do that has eroded considerably in the last few years. And we are doing everything we can to try to get knowledge and information to the people of North Korea so that this trend continues. Change takes time, said Assistant Secretary Malinowski, but when it comes, it often surprises us and goes very quickly. And I think that day will come when we see that happen in North Korea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.